I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. My guest today was first interviewed on KCBX when she was about 8 or 9 years old. And she's made many appearances on the air here since then as a musician and a music enthusiast. Now she's 29, a published author. She has a degree from UC Davis in International Agricultural Development and is co-founder of a local nonprofit therapeutic community farm. Her latest book is Growing Home. It's a novel inspired by her own experiences volunteering at a local homeless shelter and working on several farms. Dori Stone has been named the 2013 Author of the Year by Common Ground Worldwide. Welcome, Dori.
Thanks, Marisa. It's so good to be here again.
Well, it's a pleasure having you on. Your first book, Beyond the Fence, was a nonfiction examination of the migration crisis, but now you have a novel, and it's aimed at young adults. Will you give us a sort of the thumbnail plot summary?
Sure. Growing Home is a novel about a young girl named Talia and her mom, who at the beginning of the novel are homeless and are looking for a chance to get back on their feet, as Talia puts it. On their way, they stop in the town of El Choro looking for an old friend who Talia's mom hopes will help them. And things go very differently than they had expected. And Talia winds up discovering at the edge of town this community garden, which is just a magical place for her. And she becomes really involved with the community of gardeners there. And this becomes sort of like a home for her and her mom. And, well, the second crisis in the novel comes up when the future of this garden is threatened by urban development, and the gardeners are struggling to save it. And so the story is about what happens with the garden and what happens with Talia and her mom and how we all search for a place that really feels like home.
So it's really the people looking for a place and the garden also looking for a place to call home. One thing that impresses me about Growing Home is that it can be appreciated by people of all ages, even though it's aimed at the YA level. I was gripped by the story, and I didn't feel like you were talking down to the reader. And I'm wondering if you worked hard at the tone of the book to achieve that.
Well, the part about it being suited to all ages, I've been so excited to see that working, because that was my goal. The book is written in first person, and it's written by Talia, who's 10 and then 11. I don't remember ever really feeling like a kid, you know? I always felt like me. I always felt like somebody who was taking in the world and having a lot of thoughts and feelings about it, and I just wrote from that perspective. So, yeah, I guess I think in a way we're all children and we're all adults throughout our whole lives.
So something else that impressed me was how adeptly you addressed multiple social issues, everything from homelessness to mental illness to immigration, land use. It didn't feel complicated, though, or preachy. How did you work to achieve that?
I can say that this book, for me, was a way of bringing together a lot of things that I really care about and sharing them. And I think that fiction is a really powerful way to talk about pressing issues and things that we're deeply concerned about. I don't think that I was really working to do that. I think it just happened.
Maybe that's why it feels so easy. And these issues just flow and weave in and out of the story, and they feel so natural as a part of the story. For instance, Talia's mother, one of the main reasons they're homeless, I'm assuming, is because she has a mental illness, depression. You have volunteered with homeless shelters. And in your experience in working with homeless people, did you find mental illness?
Yeah, well, I think part of what I was wanting to convey in this book, and this was me processing some of my own experiences with people in my life, is the ambiguity of that term, mental illness, and the fluidity of mental health in general. Just seeing that in my experience, we all have sanity and insanity, and we all have internal clarity and internal chaos, and they come and go, and we experience them differently. And at the time I got the idea for this book, a close friend of mine who I lived with was in the hospital and was eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia. And it was a really confusing time for us to figure out what that meant and how to relate to him and how to understand what was going on and how we could best support him. And I was processing all of that, and that came into the book. I wanted to convey that it's not just this cut and dried thing. Like, there are people who are mentally healthy and people who are mentally ill, and that it's complicated, and it was complicated for me. So the book is kind of my way of working through that and also bringing that to light. And I don't want to really say that the mom is mentally ill. I wanted to leave that up to readers to think about, like, is this just her way of responding to the world? And this is just this particular unique individual. This is how she takes things in and how she responds. Can we diagnose her? Would it be helpful for her for us to do that or for us not to do that? And then what would be helpful for her and where can she fit in society? So I'm raising all these questions because I was thinking about them while I was writing.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest is Dori Stone, who's the author of Growing Home, a novel, and she's co-founder of the Loving Life Farm near Lake San Antonio. Dori, my favorite character besides Talia was Masahiro, who is the elderly Japanese man and herbalist that befriended Talia and her mother. And he really seems to be the heart of the garden and the heart of the community. Mm. Was he modeled after anyone you know?
He was influenced by a couple people I know. Actually, the person I mentioned who was in the hospital at the time that I was writing, the book is also dedicated to him. He was really into permaculture at the time and sharing with people about natural ways of gardening. So he was part of that character. Masahiro is kind of a collage of a few people. And then also someone who I didn't know personally, but Masanobu Fukuoka, who was a Japanese farmer who wrote a book called The One Straw Revolution that is extremely inspiring to me. And I was actually largely influenced by him in the creation of Masahiro.
Will you please read an excerpt from your book? This is pages 115 and 116. Talia and her mother are eating with Masahiro in his home, and he has just finished telling them about living in an internment camp. Can you set that up for us and then read the excerpt?
Sure. So what's poignant for me about this scene is that Talia and her mother are currently staying at a homeless shelter, and they're hearing Masahiro talk about his experience staying in an internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. And so there's a parallel in their experiences, and Talia realizes that he can understand what they're going through. Just to give a little background, because there are a few Japanese words in this excerpt, Nihonmachi means Japan town, and it's a word that is used to describe the area of town that was the Japanese community. Obachan, which I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, means grandmother in Japanese. And chan is an ending that's used as a term of endearment in Japanese. So you use the beginning of a person's name and then put chan.
So he calls her Tali-chan.
Right. Masahiro calls Talia Tali-chan. So this excerpt comes right after he told them the story about his experience at Gila River relocation camp. We sat together around the small wooden table in silence for a few minutes, drinking our tea and listening to the soft tick-tick of a clock in the living room. Outside the window, the sky had deepened to a dark, velvety blue, and the streetlights came on. "Did you feel homesick there?" I asked. "Yes," he replied slowly. "But the Nihonmachi in El Choro was not truly my home either. I missed Takamura Village in Japan. I knew my place was now here in America, but still, it did not feel like home." Mom cleared her throat and spoke for the first time in a while. "Did it ever get easier?" He nodded. "Yes, when I began to grow plants. I still had those seeds I carried in my clothes from Japan, you remember? So I decided to put them in the ground and tend a small garden, as Oba-chan had taught me when I was a boy. You got a plot at the community garden?" I asked. Masahiro smiled and shook his head. "No, Tali-chan, the garden did not exist then. But do you remember that tiny patch of ground behind this building, near the stairway? That is where I started." He leaned in toward us, eyes growing wider, as if to tell a secret. "Then something remarkable happened. as the plants grew, putting roots into the soil, I too began to feel more rooted and at ease in this place. I discovered that a true home cannot always be found, but is something you can grow yourself, like a garden, right where you are.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and that was Dori Stone reading an excerpt from her new novel, Growing Home. Dori is also co-founder of the Loving Life Farm, north of Paso Robles, and we'll talk a little bit more about the farm later on. Your story reminds me a little bit of the story of the South Central Farm in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
That was shut down in 2006. Did you ever visit it, or has it influenced your story growing home at all?
Yeah, that's actually what inspired me to write this book in the first place. I never actually visited, but a friend of mine was going down there a lot and helping in their struggle to save that garden. For anybody who doesn't know, that was the largest community garden in the U.S. It was actually a farm, 13 acres in South Central L.A., where a lot of people were growing a significant portion of their family's food. And the city of L.A. sold the farm to a developer, and all the gardeners were forced to leave. There's a documentary about this called The Garden, which also really impacted me. And I was so sad when that garden was destroyed and those people were forced to leave. Writing this book for me was a way of kind of restoring my own sense of hope. And I also wanted to share with young people a sense of hope that we can save places that are important to us and that the struggle is worth it.
So 95% of the proceeds from the sale of Growing Home will go toward a big project that you're working on. Tell us about Loving Life Farm.
Loving Life Farm is a big vision that has been, for me, largely inspired by my experience at the Possibility Alliance in Missouri, which is an educational farm. In addition to being about growing food, it's also about basically an experiment in how can we live on the planet in a way that helps the planet to thrive and our relationships with each other and our own selves. So anyway, I thought about moving there to Missouri, but I really missed home. And so I decided to come back here and start something similar. So Loving Life Farm will basically be a two-part project, with one part being a remote rural homestead that will be an experiment in ways of living off of the Earth's resources in a way where we're not exploiting people or natural resources, and basically experimenting with how can we live lightly on the Earth and thrive. I'm imagining that in the future we'll be offering educational stuff out there and opportunities for other people to come and participate in that. But the main place where this project will engage with the public will actually be at an urban community garden where people can grow food, harvest food, hang out, and hold community events and meetings. Another part of my life is studying nonviolent communication, and I'm really interested in conflict resolution. And so I envision the garden being a place where people can also have support in resolving conflicts nonviolently.
How interesting. And so you have actually purchased some land near Lake San Antonio, is that correct?
Yeah, the rural part of Loving Life Farm that I described first, there's actually a physical location for that part. Yeah.
But you're working on a physical location for the urban farm?
Yeah, and this is all still in a very early stage.
What is your progress so far?
Currently, we are working on getting the two old wells on the property functional so that there's some water to grow things. And we're currently at an early stage of brainstorming and community building. So people who would like to be involved in that process and just participate in discussions about what this could look like and what would best serve the community would be very welcome to contact me and talk with us. A wonderful form of support for this project at the moment is actually purchasing the book, Growing Home, and telling other people about it, because this book is, in addition to being, you know, my own passion that I wanted to share with the world regardless, it also is a fundraiser for the beginnings of Loving Life Farm, for making the payments on this property. Also, for people interested in physically getting involved, in the next few months, especially in the fall when it cools down a little bit, I would like to hold some work days out there and give people an opportunity to come see this beautiful place, get to know each other. And the question that I've been thinking about that I'd love to pose to people is, if you had 40 acres and you wanted to use it to contribute to a healthier planet and society, what would you do?
So you have some book signings coming up. Tell me when and where these book signings will be.
Okay, I currently have 3 book signings scheduled. The first one is going to be on Sunday, August 18th from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Steinberg Gallery on Monterey Street in San Luis. The next is Sunday, August 25th from 3:30 to 5 p.m. at Oak Creek Commons, which is a co-housing community in Paso Robles. And the third one is Saturday, August 31st from 3 to 5 p.m. at Brew Coffee House in Atascadero. And these will all be advertised on my website, which also has more information about the book and about Loving Life Farm. And the website is lovinglifefarm.webs.com.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Dori, for coming in and talking about your book, Growing Home, and about your project, The Loving Life Farm.
Thank you, Marisa. It's really great to share about it.
For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.
I'm Tom Wilmer. Please join us as we visit with Leslie Westbrook, who's been a professional adventurer, traveler, writer, author for years and years. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, Tom. So good to see you.
The reason why I wanted to see you has to do with your guidebook, Santa Barbara, The Insider's Guide. The 5th edition just came out.
Yeah, it's a pretty comprehensive guidebook to Santa Barbara and also some of the outlying areas. So it's more than Santa Barbara.
When I got the book, I opened it up and I got to be honest, I went, oh no, another compendium, you know, another kitchen sink approach. But by the time I was done reading your book, which I did, I went, this is even cool for a local long-term resident of Santa Barbara. I call it a user's manual to Santa Barbara.
Yeah, I learned a lot working on the book myself, and I've lived in Santa Barbara 40 years, so I thought I knew everything, and it's very comprehensive, in addition to history and, you know, the normal things, hotels and restaurants and attractions and activities. One thing that's really cool about the book is we have a whole section called Living Here.
Exactly. And I thought when I looked at that, I went, my perfect picture was a mother and a family and kids. You have so many cool recommendations of things to do and see.
I just heard from a woman I know. I just got an email from her yesterday saying, we love your book. Our grandkids are here. She told me their ages. I think they were like 7, 9, and 13. And we're using the book so we know what to do with the kids for activities. Because we've got a lot. It's very kid friendly. There's whole chapters for kids. Everything from, you know, camps to surfing, you know, in addition to all the normal stuff.
Mm-hmm. Give us some insider tips on some of your favorite recommendations for families.
Well, for starters, there's a really comprehensive section on the Channel Islands National Park. So that's really great. I've lived in Summerlin for years, but I recently moved to Carpinteria. So there's things about the Salt Marsh Nature Park, which is a great hiking spot, but more importantly, the Carpinteria Bluffs Nature Preserve, which is where all the harbor seals are. You know, there's really neat stuff in the park section. And then, you know, we have all the different activities that are going on. You know, summer is huge with Old Spanish Days Fiesta Parade, and we have the Solstice Parade. So all of those are in there. And then for the grown-ups, I have a whole chapter on Santa Barbara Wine Country.
Nice.
You'd like that.
Yeah. What do you have? Like, there's a wine trail. Tell us about that for a moment and how you cover that.
We have an urban wine trail, and I have a little bit about that. The problem with books is that the urban wine trail is growing faster than a book can come out.
And any best picks?
Well, I talk about some of the Appalachians, like Happy Canyon, which I think is a really cool part of the San Ynez Valley to explore. I do like the urban wine trail because it means you don't have to go up to Santa Ynez if you want to go wine tasting.
And you can leave your car or your hotel. You can do it all on foot.
Well, you can take the train. A lot of tourists do that. They take the train and it's a block, and you have half a dozen and growing more wineries.
Inbound visitor, yeah. But if you are already settled in your hotel in Santa Barbara, you can walk to do your wine tasting.
Right, or they have Segway tours too, so you could jump on a Segway and taste wine.
That's scary. Yeah. Have you done that? Have you tried the Segway?
I tried one once, but I haven't gone wine. I haven't mixed wine and Segway. Right.
One of the aspects that I've always loved about Santa Barbara is its history going way back, and it's a living history. You can walk it and feel it. Tell us about some of the not-to-be-missed historic sites.
Well, the area was originally settled by the Chumash Indians, and there's a place called Burton Mound, which is right on Cabrillo Boulevard, and there's a new tile sculpture that's been done on the boulevard there that kind of commemorates that. So, and then of course it goes back to Cabrillo discovering us, and then we have the islands. And we had the Presidio, which has all been restored, so it has this old Californio history from the Native Americans, of course, then when the Catholic and the missions were built and all of that influence, which of course changed everything quite a bit. And then people started coming later, the very rich started coming out to Montecito and Santa Barbara because for health reasons, and they would take the train out, and it became a destination for the wealthy. And we have an incredible philanthropic history that goes way back to that period too, because some of the richest families, Fleshman from Fleshman Yeast, built the breakwater. So there are a lot of interesting personalities. Ganawalska, we have Lotus Land, and she was an opera singer who married very well several times and built these incredible botanic gardens that you can visit by appointment.
How about the mission? The iconic mission is really a must-do.
The Queen of the Missions is what our Santa Barbara mission is, and it's a beautiful mission, and it still functions as a church, a Catholic church, so you can go to service there. It's also where many events take place, including the annual Emo Denari, which is the street chalk painting. So our courthouse is iconic with the sunken gardens. And during the summer, there's movies there. During Fiesta, there's concerts there on the steps. People get married there. But in the meantime, in the courthouse, it functions, and that's where, you know, criminals are tried. So we have a living history, but we also use these buildings, and they function for day-to-day life for Santa Barbarians.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a moment about State Street and walking, strolling, things to see, not to be missed, food and shops.
Since this book came out, we have had a little bit more of a revolution in the culinary scene there. So we have a lot more smaller, chef-driven, farm-to-table restaurants that have popped up. I have a few favorite restaurants in the book, which I've starred. Julianne is one. There's a great Mexican restaurant on Milpa Street, La Superica Taqueria, a place that was made quite well-known by Julia Child, a former Santa Barbara resident. But there's another place called Los Agaves that's terrific, owned by a young man who moved to Santa Barbara from Mexico, and he's opened a second location as well. We have favorite picks in the book that we've starred. So both Julianne and Los Agaves are a couple of favorite restaurants, and there are many others. State Street's changed quite a bit. You know, a lot of the mom-and-pop stores can't survive there with rising rents, so it has become a little less unique than some of our other neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. But you do have some flagship shops there.
Yeah, we have Restoration Hardware, and we have Macy's and Nordstrom's in the Paseo Nuevo, and some of the other ones. But we have a new bookstore, which is great, called Granada Books. And so we still have a few independent bookstores in Santa Barbara, mm-hmm. which is wonderful.
Which means the locals truly support them.
Yeah, we have book signings there. So, you know, that's been great for me with the book.
Let's talk about some of your favorite restaurants.
Okay, well, I mentioned Los Arroyos and Julianne, which is a favorite. There's a little hole in the wall called Petite Valentienne, which is a wonderful little French restaurant near the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. Very reasonably priced, delicious food. There's a fairly new restaurant called Scarlet Begonia with a marvelous chef, and they just opened for dinners recently and got their liquor license. Anchor Woodfire Pizza is a new restaurant next to the Indigo Hotel, which is down by the train station. Another excellent chef. Those are a few top picks.
Okay, so I'm coming down from Northern California. Leslie's recommendations of places to stay.
Good question. Well, depends on your pocketbook.
Let's do low-end, high-end.
Well, let's start high-end because that's always the easiest.
And the most fun.
San Ysidro Ranch, of course, would be a top pick. Absolutely beautiful getaway. You know, it's been a place for movie stars, and it's you just can't beat it. Beautiful cottages, gorgeous pool, nice chef. San Ysidro Ranch is a top pick. It's also owned by Ty Warner, the Beanie Baby billionaire who owns the Four Seasons Biltmore. Another stunning property, beautiful gardens, lovely rooms, great food. The El Encanto, as you know, opened recently, and that's another top pick. Fantastic views, wonderful pool. Chef's still working out his kinks there, but I'm liking what he's doing a lot. I like the appetizers very, very much, and they have cheese from their local cow, their own cow named Ellie, that's terrific. So
the El Encanto is one of those places that even if you don't stay there, it's a must-do for dinner or lunch or something, because talk about the commanding view and its location.
Yeah, and they have a jazz singer there, I think Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, so you can just go have a drink, enjoy the view, sunset, and get some of that cheese.
Okay, let's mention something affordable.
On the more affordable end, the Franciscan Inn is a good choice. A couple of bed and breakfasts, like the old Yacht Club Inn or Secret Garden Inn. And there's a couple places that are down by the waterfront. The Cabrillo Inn at the beach, Casa del Mar. Some of those rooms have full kitchens. So here comes my train.
Yeah. Well, Leslie, we're just about out of time, and that's because your train has just rolled in to take you home to Santa Barbara from San Luis Obispo. Before we go, any last comments about your book, Santa Barbara?
We do have a chapter on living there, so anyone that's thinking of moving to Santa Barbara has all kinds of things about education, real estate, hospitals, education. So it's really comprehensive. It's great if you're a visitor. It's great if you live there and you want it for house guests, and it's great if you're thinking of moving to Santa Barbara.
For further information about your book and Leslie A. Westbrook,
LeslieWestbrook.com.
And that'll get to the book information, too?
You can buy the book on Amazon. You can Google Insider's Guide to Santa Barbara and my name, Leslie Westbrook. Or if you want a signed copy, you can contact me via my email, LeslieAWestbrook@gmail.com.
Leslie, thanks again for visiting. This has been great.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's wonderful to see you, and thank you so much for this opportunity.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the Amtrak train station in San Luis Obispo, California, where we've been visiting with author Leslie Westbrook.
What is a prime particle, and what does the box look like in which it travels? Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Chrissy Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a program which focuses on the visual arts. Co-host Stephen DeLuque and I produce it here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Today, we visit with Timo Beckwith and Billy Clayton. They are two of the seven artists who are the core of a new interdisciplinary experimental event collaborative, the title of which is Prime Particle Productions. It is the desire of this multifaceted group to present free, artistic, live productions as a means of displaying the vast reaches of what it means to be creative. They readily admit that the work done in preparation for this first event has changed their lives and their thinking about creativity. Their hope is that the impact on those in attendance will be similar. Stephen and I sat down with Timo and Billy at Timo's home here in San Luis Obispo. Join us now for the conversation. Timo Beckwith, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chrissa and Stephen.
And with Billy Clayton.
Hi, how are you?
The purpose of today's interview is going to be to discuss a brand new project that, Timo, you have helped bring together, so I'm going to let you give us that overview.
Thank you, Chrissa. Well, the project is called Prime Particle Productions. It wasn't really seeded by me. I think it was seeded by Billy and Amber. Bill and Amber put on a show at the Grange Hall with Mama Crow, and Ted Emmerich also was involved in that, and there was a lot of video production and sculpture, and it was so great to see some of the video capture of musicians on the stage projected onto sculpture And they've been thinking about this concept and expanding upon it for some time before I got involved. And then I got involved and we started really honing it down to where we have created an event production company of a very unusual type. We struck on the name Prime Particle Productions. And the fun thing about that is the word particle is spelled lowercase p, uppercase A-R-T, lowercase I-C-L-E. So art stands out, and that's really what this company is about. We're about bringing together a huge array of different forms of creativity into creating the events that actually engage people.
Billy, do you want to add something to that?
It seems like all of us combined kind of had the same vision of getting involved with other musicians, other artists. Amber and I were talking and came up with the idea that we wanted to do some sort of event. We mentioned it to Timo, and then we had the opportunity to display some my vision in projecting and sculpture and putting art up on the sculpture. And once we did that, it gave a visual representation of what I'd been talking about, because it was awful hard to explain. And once everybody saw it, it just took off.
Can you give a little more description of what you mean by the video or the art on the sculpture?
The art we wanted to project at first onto a flat surface, because that's how you think of projection. And then we went to a play at Cal Poly. They were moving screens into the projections, because I could never figure out how you could try and follow a projection with a screen, especially if they were odd-shaped. And so when I saw that, then that kind of opened up a door. And then because I worked for a video production company, the video part of it just kind of fell into place. And then I mentioned it to Ted Emmerich, and he says, "Oh, I already know what I want to make for this. I've always been wanting to do this." So he built these sculptures with a reflective surface, but it also could be lit from inside, and we put the projections up on them, and we're overwhelmed with what the possibilities of all of that could mean. So then we put together the show at the Grange, and Timo played at that also. And there were some images we had, I think, of Timo playing an instrument that he had made and zoomed into his hands and putting those up on the projections that really started to make everybody think of, we've got something here and we can do something pretty cool with it.
So we're going from 3D to flat, as it's usually projected, but now back to 3D.
Oh, yeah. We're doing a lot of video capture. You see them on stage, but then you see maybe their hands or their face really huge, but not just on a screen, on an actual sculpture that is black behind it. So the image actually stays on the sculpture. It's not like there's a sculpture in the way of the image. It's like the sculpture becomes the screen. And that just really, you know, sparked a big spark. And we had talked about doing some events out in nature, which we're still talking about, where those pods actually float on the water, and sending wireless feed to them and having projectors inside them or out on beams. And so we're capturing what's going on shore and taking it out into the water, projected onto these pods that are floating. That's really exciting too, and that's in the works down the road. But I think one of the most exciting things about the idea of what we're doing, and I think the real deep motivation for it, is to really stimulate creativity and imagination in a way that is way outside of the box. We're going to be putting on these events that harken back in some regards to the concept of the happenings of the 60s, but with a much more fine art bent to them, in that we're incorporating so many elements, as many as we can. We'll probably have elements incorporated that we haven't even thought of yet as the process unfolds. But one of the processes is, of course, what we talked about, the video capture. It could also be projected onto a ceiling or onto a wall, or onto the bodies of whoever's there, So that's one aspect, video capture, and then video production. So we're going out and doing production where we say we shoot into a pool, or we take pictures of water in a pool, and then we could tweak that so that it doesn't really look like water, but it has that energy, and maybe put a ball of fire in the middle of a circle of moving water, and then put a silhouette of a dancer just going off inside the ball of fire, and then project that onto a sculpture, or project that onto the bodies of dancers. And I think open up the idea of what is creativity to people in the community. What could be done that is outside the box? And we may have musicians, live musicians, but they're not going to be on a stage. They're going to be in the room playing. There'll be music, dance, costume design, painting, digital art, video production, sculpture, poetry, spoken word. We're going to really mix these things up as much as possible. And we're very excited because our very first event will be at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art on August 24th from 6 to 9 p.m.
It might sound like a naive question, but there's a reason why I'm asking it. Would you define for this project what you consider the box? If we're going outside the box, I'm asking for a definition of the box.
Oh, okay. The box is usually a stage, a theater, and a stage. And you have performers up on a stage performing, and an audience sitting in chairs or standing or somehow watching them. So that's one aspect that's way outside the box, is we're going beyond that, and going beyond even in many cases having what people would consider a normal space to do something like this in, as we may be doing it in nature, and it will be open to whoever shows up.
What we're looking to do is be able to scale this to any size, shape, form, and still be able to do an interactive performance with the audience that's there. And I think that really steps outside the box. I mean, having something that's so scalable that we could play a small coffee shop, or we could be in a total, complete outdoor setting at a festival or anything else and still be able to do all of this. So, and I think the other part that I'd say is outside the box is that we're taking artists that are accomplished and are used to working as individuals on their own projects. That is one of the things that make us artists. We have that kind of drive, and we're used to controlling whatever it is we're working with, and we're very temperamental about all of that. And to bring in a group of artists and try and find common ground and keep the personalities where nobody dominates and yet everybody contributes, that's pretty outside the box, but has been a lot of fun to watch it as it evolves. And then some really nice stuff starts happening, because then we start feeding off of each other's energy. To have this kind of talent around you that you feed off, which inspires you to push yours forward and expand your limits of what you've been doing. And then you also get to see what everybody's doing, and it gives you more ideas and the way it all goes. So it's outside the box that way for sure.
And I use that phrase because for me, sometimes it feels as though people say it as a justification for what they think is throwing the box away. How do we make this work? All sorts of ways that you're just pushing and pushing and pushing. What can we do with this?
I think in order to think outside the box, that you have to recognize the existence of the box. Otherwise, you don't know if you're outside it or inside it. So it's one of those things that I think it's really interesting to establish what the norm is for that particular type of expression, and then stepping beyond that and going outside of it that way.
One of the aspects that I think of as being outside the box or the normal convention is that taking the concept of creative activities and then working with that creative activity and that creative energy and juice in new ways. That's what's really exciting to me. For example, I have a whole series of drawings that I've been working on for 20, 30 years. I call them the Shadow Series, and they merged into the Shadow Merger prints, merging digital art with this drawing form. and then they're merging into sculpture. And now we've taken that concept of these shapes, and we actually did some video at the beach that merged dance with drawing by taking these long bamboo poles that I made and doing a kind of improvisational dance as we drew these kinds of shapes in the sand, really large scale, on a clean beach after a high tide, and then videoed that from above. So there we're merging video, drawing, and dance all together in a new kind of production that then will be perhaps projected onto sculptures, or maybe it'll be projected onto the bodies of the dancers or the audience. We don't really know, because that part will be a little bit improvisational.
If you are wondering, what is this program and who am I listening to, ponder no longer. This is Ears on Art, found only here on KCBX Public Radio. Stephen DeLuque and I, Chrissy Hewitt, are talking with Timo Beckwith and Billy Clayton, two of the core team of Prime Particle Productions. We continue now as each describes his individual art background.
I'll start with Billy.
Really started with music, and started when I was 8 years old. Played saxophone in the school band, and once I had an instrument in my hand, I was hooked. Glad we're on radio so you can't really see how old I am, but it was a long time ago that it started. And then blossomed from there, majored in voice in college, and then was in the service and kind of dropped out for a while, then got back into it and played in bands and a lot of writing. Began writing lyrics as well as music. Art-wise, I had a family and I had to feed my family, so I worked as a house painter. Oddly enough, it gave me a lot of insight into how spray works, and I got some airbrushes in my hand and realized I could airbrush, which was very strange because I couldn't draw stick figures very well, but for some reason, as soon as I had an airbrush in my hand, I could do these unbelievable photographic-looking images. And then that evolved into digital arts, and I was also in the coffee business, and we thought at the beginning of the internet would be a good time to have a website, and we could sell 1 million pounds of coffee. So we built one of the first coffee websites that ever was, and put it up on the internet and said, wow, how does anybody know it's there? And that became the great search. And I was working with a group that was also just getting into 3D digital animation. One of the things we had looked at and saw that we thought the internet was moving into was chat, which it did. And then we thought it would evolve into 3D chat environments, and we actually got involved in it in 1996 and started building 3D chat environments. At the same time, I had started a coffee business, and it started with a cart, and then we decided to move it into and make a coffee house. And when we did, we had built a world, a 3D chat world environment with actually had sculptures and animation going on in the environment. And the mayor of Morro Bay came and cut the rope at our store when we opened, and then sat down at a computer, and we were the first internet cafe on the Central Coast. So she sat down and hosted a chat environment with people from many different parts of the world. They were really ringers that we knew from, because really that was the only people that were surfing in that area at the time. And there were people from Germany and Switzerland and Australia and New Zealand and the United States. So we did the world's first ever virtual reality grand opening over the internet. Getting involved in that end of it, I found that I had a talent for being able to manipulate pixels, really, and create art. And then that has evolved into using photographs and then taking them into the digital realm and adding all kinds of things to them. And that's kind of my history.
Whoa.
That's an incredible journey.
Okay, Timo, can you top that one?
Well, I don't know. I have a different story altogether. I think I'm kind of an old guy too, but I've been doing art. Sometimes people say, when did you decide to be an artist? And my response is always the same. I didn't. It just was who I came into this world as an artist. I can remember, you know, the kindergarten teacher dragging my parents in to see some drawing I had done in crayons of a brush fire that happened, because as a little boy I thought brush fires were really exciting, with the firemen coming and the hoses dragging and the flames and all that. So nobody had to push me, I just did it, you know. And I did a lot of drawing, a lot of painting, a lot of sculpture. And then when I was about 8 years old, I started playing drums. Then I graduated into playing drums and recorder, and then other stringed instruments and vocals later in life. And so I do a lot of music. And then in terms of the visual art, I feel like I'm always pulling on a thread that's attached to a ball of string, and I never know what's on the other end. So whatever the thread is, it's there. I pull on it, and something always gets revealed. And that's probably why I do so many different forms of art. I've always had an interest in masks and indigenous art. I think the Museum of Man in Balboa Park in San Diego had a huge influence on my life and my interest in anthropology and the art and music and dance and just culture in general of many different countries throughout the world. So in that regard, the mask making, I got into that. I was carving palm fronds when I was 12 years old and making masks that people were hanging on their walls. And then that is, as that evolved, and I really wanted to make masks that were wearable as tools of transformation, which is what they are, for real performances, rituals, Mardi Gras, parades, films. One of my masks was worn by Tyra Banks in a John Singleton film. And then I got into exploring the material aspect. How do I make these things really light? What do I use? How can I control the form and still make them function ergonomically so you can dance in them and they don't hurt? That was one of the threads that really I pulled on a long, long time, to find all these different materials and ways to accomplish those things. And then those materials migrate into sculpture. Whatever it is, it always initiates something else. There's a kind of cross-pollination. In high school, I had two art classes, and then the teacher said, well, you know what? You can just come in here on my free period, which was once a day for the last 2 years, and do whatever you want and use the materials. And so that was cool. And then I was on a journey after leaving San Diego, and I was trying to sleep in a laundromat in Larkspur. Two guys came in, they go, who are you? What's up? And I go, oh, I'm just on a journey. And they go, we live here in Mill Valley or Larkspur, and we're going to this school over in the East Bay in Oakland. It's called California College of Arts and Crafts. And then they told me about it, and I said, wow, that sounds really fantastic. They said, well, come on over, and we'll show you around. Hung out there at California College of Arts and Crafts for a couple of days, and I was just like, wow, this is my kind of school, right? Sculpture studios, metal studios, jewelry, ceramics, painting, everything. I came back to San Luis Obispo, lived here for a year, got a little bit of money, moved to Berkeley in 68, and went to summer school, majored in sculpture. Since I've been here, it's just been a constant exploration. And when I started doing recording and producing albums, and I really wanted to be able to produce cover art for those albums, I got into photography, and that has really morphed into a merger with a lot of other things I do. I've always had a huge interest in dance and have done a lot of work in the ecstatic dance realm. Had a long, long interest in film. So I decided I really wanted to do some filmmaking. I wanted to do a dance film. I did a dance film in Joshua Tree. Did that and just loved it, because it melded nature, costume, music, dance, and film, all those arts in one. And then that translates into some of the work we're doing for Prime Particle Productions.
I think the journey is a wonderful word here because it's just obviously just an ongoing opening of passageways.
Mm-hmm. It's about giving. You know, I think as artists, we just want to give something of spirit to the world that will stimulate that upliftment in our planet. And we need it, you know, because creating art is really, to me, it's actually a spiritual practice because any artist knows that where does this stuff come from? You know, where does this stuff that I do ever come from? Well, we don't know. You know, nobody knows. You know, I don't care if you're a jazz artist or a dancer. When you drop into the pocket, you drop into that place where you're just doing it, and then you go, wow, look what just came out of me. That's what I mean by it being, in my opinion, a spiritual practice, and it can be pursued as such. And then this concept of process and just engagement is so very important. All you have to do is engage that process and walk that path, and things will happen, because no matter how accomplished you are, you only got there by walking that path. Great art gets produced. It gets produced by engaging the process. And I've begun to think of all artworks as only artifacts of the process. So that the actual artwork isn't nearly as important as the process.
I agree with you about how we're so product-oriented is the fact that I've often told people, it's like, after I finish a painting, I'm done with it. I don't really care what happens to it. It's like, to me, I learned what I needed to from the painting by going through the process of painting it. And the image itself pretty much doesn't have much worth to me at that point. And so I often paint over images over and over and over again. And I know a lot of artists find that just absolutely blasphemous, that you're supposed to preserve these things. And it's like, nah, not really. I've done it. It's fine.
And then in terms of affecting people, you know, I played for a long time with Chris O'Connell in a group called Human Human, which was really pretty exotic world fusion music. What I've found out is just by being out in the world is that people will come up to me that I don't know at all and say, you know what, man, I was like in high school and, you know, you played that music and it just stimulated something in me. And now I play the guitar and I didn't think I ever would. And you see that what you've done actually had an impact that you didn't know was there. You can't always measure the impact. It's not an applause. It's because you put yourself out in the world and open it up to people to encounter your process that's how you stimulate it in other people. And it does happen.
I'm so glad that you called me the other day, Timo, and alerted us to what you're working on, because as somebody who's in many different ways been trying to advocate for cross-discipline, interdisciplinary, whatever you want to call it, that we don't live in vacuums. And I give three cheers to the whole idea that you've got going here, which just seems that it doesn't have an end.
I think so, too. It's once I got involved with these guys, it was just, it's been an amazing, amazing experience and very stimulating. We come up with ideas that I think feed each other, and that's really what pushes everything forward. People that attend one of these happenings will actually find themselves part of the art that's happening. When Amber and I first talked about this, we said we wanted to create something that you walked in with one perspective, and when you left, you had a different perspective. Well, I know for me, it's altered my experience, so.
Well, I think that's a really sound place to close this part of the conversation. Plan is next week to continue with a little more in-depth conversation with the animator.
Mm-hmm. James Satoru Strauss.
Join us for that, and thank you, Billy.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and it's been a pleasure.
And Timo?
Thank you, Krista. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Billy.
And Stephen.
Thank you both. I can't wait to hear more.
This has been Ears on Art. And our conversation today has been with Timo Beckwith and Billy Clayton, two of the 7 member team that comprises a brand new multidisciplinary group entitled Prime Particle Productions. what they are doing can certainly be compared with the art happenings of the 60s. But in this case, they are bringing to it a whole lot more thanks to technology, as well as a real upbeat spirit of inclusiveness and creativity. Their first event will be at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art on August 24th from 6 to 9. That's a Saturday. It follows closely on the heels of the art opening for the juried sculpture exhibit Slam. Should be quite an evening. We'll continue this conversation next week. Timo Beckwith will be here, and so will internationally recognized computer animator James Satoru Strauss. Ears on Art is a program which co-host Stephen DeLuque and I produce here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. It is a twice-monthly part of the audio magazine Issues and Ideas. I want to thank our guests, Timo Beckwith and Billy Clayton. Till next week, thank you so much for listening.